The Big Picture, brought to you by Bible Society Australia, shining the light of God's Word into every corner of your world. And Sydney's Hope 103.2, there's always hope. The Big Picture, a Christian insight on the world of film, television and popular culture, with magazine editor Ben McKechin and scriptwriter Mark Hadley.
G'day, I'm Ben McKechin.
And I'm his life coach, Mark Hadley. Welcome
so
to
true.
Episode 33 of The Big Picture for the week beginning October 12. Coming up on today's show, the Beatles were right. It's love, love, and something like love in Network 10's The Bachelorette.
Toni Collette and Drew Barrymore are BFFs in crisis in Miss You Already at cinemas.
And a new take on marriage, well, for Hollywood at least, in the rom-com Learning to Drive. October 12 is a fine week to focus on that saccharine sweet staple of the Hollywood menu, the romantic comedy.
And
Ben and I at The Big Picture are not averse to partaking of that particular delicacy, even if it's cooked up by Nicholas Sparks or served by Catherine Hardwicke and includes a side order of Goldie Hawn in the finest Billy Crystal. No, that's because we are both connoisseurs of heartfelt comedy, ever since our wives came along and forced us to put down the remote. But don't assume you know what you're getting when your waiter tells you there's a special on rom-com. This week sees the release of two particular productions that show just how diverse that label can be, much like the vast difference between a Burgundy from Marseillais and a Montenay. Oh, gosh, what a funny misunderstanding that was.
That made better sense when you wrote it down.
Well, Miss You Already reminds us that friendship is just as fruitful a field for finding enduring relationships and comedy, and Learning to Drive suggests real love can begin the day the marriage ends, and they're just for starters. But speaking of starters, it's time for the news. Cue to the cutting-edge sound effect. Yeah, we didn't have that this week, did we?
No, we didn't. No, we should have talked about that before. Instead, I'll just get to the news.
What's coming out in film?
What also is at cinemas this week is Crimson Peak, this new film from Guillermo del Toro, guy probably best known for Pan's Labyrinth. And it's like, it's Mexican director's version of American Gothic, haunted house story, weird people, weird stuff happens, weirdness. Crimson Peak is at cinemas now.
Thrilling.
Hopefully it is. I've got to see it soon. I'm looking forward to it.
Okay, you can hold my hand. SBS has kicked off its new Australian thriller, The Principal, the four-part series which started last week, but it's available on SBS
Demand. I watched the first episode. I really liked it.
It is really, really good. And it's about the efforts of Principal Matt Bashir to reform the ruffian high school at Boxdale, which has been complicated more than a little by the discovery of a body behind the bins. That tends to upset teachers.
Yeah, it really does. On DVD and Blu-ray this week, another Australian choice. I think this is arguably, Mark, the most underrated movie of this year, a film called Partisan. I really like this. I feel like I'm the only person that watched this movie. It stars a French actor, Vincent Cassel. It's in this sort of new near future place that didn't even give much detail about what's going on.
That explains gives too why much, you're the only guy who watched it.
It gives too much away. But for me, a really effective film. It particularly talks about a lot of stuff going on at the moment, but from a slightly different angle. And that's as mysterious and vague as I'm going to be. Partisan. Check it out.
And starting on Wednesday, my pick of the year for funny, the XPM. Sean McKellar stars as our third longest-serving Prime Minister, Andrew Dugdale, who once dined with presidents and kings and hosted world summits and changed the lives of millions of his fellow Australians and now finds himself a retired, not-so-elder statesman with time on his hands. He's trying to put together his memoirs with a bunch of misfits left over from his career. It is champagne comedy.
Oh, in major romance news this week, Mark, and this is the romance news that I know you've been gagging for.
I was gagging.
That Stephanie Meyer, the author of Twilight,
now I'm gagging,
has decided to reimagine Twilight, and there's a new book coming called Life and Death, Twilight Reimagined, that is from the, they're swapping the gender roles and the perspectives are different. So somehow now we're going to have Beau instead of Bella and Edith instead of Edward.
What, you mean, seriously, they're just going to change the sexes of the key characters?
Not just that, I'm sure a massive movie franchise is also on its way, Mark. Twilight Reimagined.
How can this be called a novel? I mean, isn't this just a function in Microsoft? You know, find and change?
Let's rant more news.
Okay. Since Ridley Scott started the publicity tour for The Martian, we've learned a lot about his upcoming Prometheus sequel. Now with an official title of Alien Paradise Lost.
Really?
If there was ever a paradise.
I thought Twilight Reimagined was kind of lame.
Okay. It's expected for release in 2017. Look, and just in case you weren't a Prometheus fan, good news. The film takes us back to the origins of the original Alien series and is expected to investigate just when exactly those pesky xenomorphs came from. But also, stay tuned for more information about Alien 5. Yes, we were all up to Alien 4. Well, Alien 5, directed by Neil Blomkamp, the next installment in the Alien series, is going to be in 2018.
Romantic. But onto a more romantic choice for this
week,
Mark.
That was my wife and my first date, Alien 4. Seriously.
What are the kids watching this week, Mark?
Not Alien 4, I can tell you.
No.
Back to our romantic comedy theme for this week, and a warning, the following program is probably neither romantic nor very funny, when you think about it. But what it is popular viewing. And so our choice for what your kids are watching this week. Network 10's The Bachelorette may sound more like a Demtel shaving device, but it's actually our local adaptation of the US series by the same name, which is in itself a spin-off of The Bachelor. 14 eligible men vie each week for the affections of Sam Frost, a 26-year-old marketing manager from Victoria, and each week, well, sometimes twice if she's in the mood, poor beautiful Sam is taken to a number of exotic locations where she dumps one of them, crushes them on national television, if you will. Will she find true love? Let's hope so, at least for their sake. Sam is the champion of season 2 of The Bachelor, and she spent 14 weeks coaxing a marriage proposal out of that show's bachelor and then dumping him before the final show went to air. How television romance is going to work for her? Who knows?
Previously on The Bachelorette.
I've booked out the entire SCG just for Dave and I.
Sam turned on a spectacular first date.
How amazing is this?
And Dave came out swinging.
Oh, my God.
Get a boundary, get a kiss, all right, mate?
Ooh. All right.
There he is.
But is Drew falling too hard?
Batting those eyelashes up.
Oh, sorry.
Too fast.
It's actually quite hard to control. Right.
This is the first Australian edition of The Bachelorette, and it confuses me that it's averaging just under a million viewers an episode. Ben, are you excited by what you've seen?
No, I'm not. But I have actually watched it, Mark, and I've watched The Bachelor as well, the more recent series.
Oh, so you're actually, like, you're quite well informed.
I'm somewhat informed. I've seen a couple of episodes, purely for research purposes, I might point out. And so, no, I'm not terribly...
Oh, I'm sorry, I'm just getting a telephone call from your wife saying something quite different. Anyway, go ahead.
I'm not terribly excited by it, no, but as you just pointed out, around a million people tune into this show on a weekly basis. There's got to be something to it that people are looking at. What I'm most amazed by, I think, of The Bachelorette, as you just mentioned, Sam Frost, The Bachelorette, was in a previous edition of The Bachelor. She got all the way. She won it. She won the heart of The Bachelor. She dumped him, and now she gets another chance at it.
I know. What are they thinking?
Are there not other single women out there who would love the opportunity that's afforded by The Bachelorette? What? Instead, Sam Frost, is she just going to throw it back in their face at the end?
I want to know what the 14 guys are thinking. I mean, seriously. I mean, wouldn't you not be going, poison chalice? I will go out in week one.
But massively popular.
There you go. Well, there are lots of sorts of dating programs like this now, actually. What do you think of the format as a suggestion of how you're supposed to go about finding a partner? I mean, I'm not sure everybody can replicate this, but the idea of basically exotic location, wow them with your personality or your expense account, and this will somehow get you a life partner.
Yeah, the format, it is an interesting one because it is a competition. It's a competition for someone's heart. And the show, the bits that I've seen of it, you get this real collision happening here where I think it seems at least that people are genuinely wanting to be in a relationship with somebody. And in this case, the 14 guys with this one particular woman. And Sam Frost seems to want to be in a relationship with somebody, which may be out of these 14 guys.
But it seems to.
But it's still a competition. And so the bit about the format that I find the hardest thing to watch is to witness people, like they have group dates on these shows where like six blokes and Sam show up and then they do kind of romantic stuff while other guys are watching on. And then they have to sort of, the guys have to sort of impress her as much as they can. And she also, you know, goes on individual dates with them and says how much she likes them to their face and then to the camera. And so you get this really confusing tapestry of, I understand that she's trying to work out who she's into, apparently, but you get all these mixed messages being sent by the show of exactly who is it that you're into and liking, and it seems like you like all of them in a similar way. I'm confused by what actually is at the heart of all of this. What it to me just seems like a confusing competition.
It all seems really ephemeral, just the idea that you're going to like this one today, not so impressed with him tomorrow.
Yeah, it's could a little bit like that. And the fact you've got to impress as well, but then there's all this talk about honesty and openness and we want to learn about your heart and who you truly are.
But
and
don't yet, show anything that would actually and yeah, lower your stock.
Go back to the bit with all these exotic locations, you're doing these amazing challenges and you're out of your comfort zone and all that, but you're still doing weird stuff that you don't do in normal life to impress somebody in front of 10 other guys who are trying to do the same thing.
So, okay, so clearly competitive dating sounds like something that we should all be wary of.
Does the Bible give anything? But then the popularity show would suggest maybe we shouldn't. Like, people are tuning in to watch this. There's something appealing about it.
Well, you know, next week we're doing a special on Crash and Burn in film, and possibly that might be what people are tuning in for. Look, does the Bible give anything close to approaching dating advice?
I don't think not so much, not explicitly. I think a lot of people can be frustrated by that, going to the Bible wanting to know who's the person I should love and what kind of person should I seek for myself for my life and to be with them. And the Bible isn't explicit about that. It doesn't have here's a 20 bullet point list of the checklist that you should go off and look for. What the Bible talks more about, though, and Jesus is a great example of this, what Jesus does and what Jesus says, it's about character. It's about who you are as a person, and not what the Bachelorette demonstrates, where you get sound bites and people will still be trying to perform, for want of a better word. Jesus talks more about what's truly at the heart of you, and not just for you, but for the other person. So the Bible really strongly suggests, if you're going looking on for dating advice, it's about what kind of person are you and what kind of person are you looking for? And then you together, how can you best serve each other, best love each other, to be the best people you can be for God and for other people? It's such a self-directed focus that's mentioned in the Bible and particularly encapsulated in Jesus that I think is in complete contrast to what's going on in The Bachelorette. And later in the show, we're going to have an interview with someone who was involved, an actress who was involved in the most recent Bachelor series. I think she puts a finger on exactly what is the appeal of The Bachelor, why people are tuning in. It's basically, we want love and we want to be in a relationship with someone. Where I think that the way you would look for other advice, though, on that is thinking more about the person you are, who you'd want to be with, and what that will mean for each other, the benefits for each other, as opposed to just constantly thinking about yourself and how you look and are we going to get together at the end of the season?
How to impress.
Yeah. The Bachelorette now showing.
The Bachelorette, yes, the Oxford Dictionary actually insists this is a real word, is rated PG for mild, coarse language, and airs Wednesdays and Thursdays on Network 10 at 7:30 p.m. And now you know when to ask the kids to put the bins out.
Coming up on the show, a nostalgic soundtrack choice and what men and women make of this BFF chick flick, Miss You Already.
You're with Ben and Mark on The Big Picture as we take a look at popular culture from a Christian perspective. And we're up to soundtrack, one of our favourite segments where we talk about the music behind films. Well, this song is the rom-com equivalent of royalty. In its original form, it was used in not less than 12 films. But actually, I'm not interested in the original version. I prefer the one played by a 500-pound Hawaiian with the voice of an angel.
dreams that you dream of, dreams really do come true.
Over the Rainbow by Israel Kamakawiwa-Oli features in multiple films and television programs, including Finding Forrester, Meet Joe Black, 50 First Dates, Son of Mask, Snakes on a Plane even gets this in, Charmed, South Pacific, Cold Case, ER, Life on Mars, Horizon, and Scrubs. Look, it was recorded, strangely, in the middle of a balmy Honolulu night in 1998. Israel called a recording studio at 3 a.m., and he was given 15 minutes to arrive by the sound recorder. He put up some microphones, did a quick sound check, rolled tape, and Israel surprised everybody by playing Somewhere Over the Rainbow. One take, and it was over. As of October 2014, the song has sold over 4.2 million digital copies.
Can't I, oh, someday I wish upon a star, wake up where the clouds are far behind. Trouble melts like a lemon drops high above the chimney top. That's where you find me, oh, somewhere over the rainbow, way up high. And the dream that you dare to, why, oh, why can't I
the good old days of the 80s, why do they feel like they were so long ago? Maybe that's just my thinning hair. Beaches was a huge hit. One for the ladies, Beaches starred Bette Midler and Barbara Hershey as lifelong friends who experienced the ups, downs, and in-betweens of life. At cinemas now, and almost 30 years after Beaches, Miss You Already stars Toni Collette and Drew Barrymore as lifelong friends who experience the ups and downs and in-betweens of life. Hope Breakfast's Laura joins us for a female-male breakdown on what Miss You Already reveals about mates, mortality, and making up. G'day and welcome.
Thank you. Hello.
Millie, my best friend. We did everything together. While Millie wasn't always entirely appropriate, she became a wonderful mother. While I was still just an auntie.
Your eggs are ready.
Not according to this. I didn't have many pictures that Millie wasn't in. She was always there.
I miss you already.
The lump is malignant.
Hey, what are you up to at lunchtime?
Is everything okay?
Laura, do you think Miss You Already is trying to sort of put itself as a successor for Beaches? I mean, it sounds kind of remarkably similar.
I don't think it can get away from the comparison, of course. I don't think the filmmakers would have gone in thinking, hey, let's make the next Beaches. Let's see how much like that film
somewhere
this can
be. Somewhere in Hollywood, there is a producer going, let's make the next Beaches.
Let's do it. Okay. But for sure, I mean, when you are talking about people facing breast cancer, friends going through the diagnosis of a disease, etc., you cannot get away from the link.
And that's what we get here in Miss You Already, isn't it? For anyone who doesn't know the basic storyline, Millie is, was mentioned in the clip. She's played by Toni Collette. She's been very successful in her life, but when we meet her in the film where she gets the diagnosis of breast cancer, she's lifelong friends with Jess, played by Drew Barrymore. They're both living in London in quite different ends of London, even though it's remarkably photogenic and all kinds of cool that they're living in. But Jess is working for a not-for-profit and she's trying to have a baby. That's the basic plot. It's a basic setup of what you get in Miss You Already. And then as we're just talking about, Mortality Issues in Shoe.
Now, you guys have got one up on me because both you have actually seen this film and I haven't. So I feel my lead question...
Take that, Mark.
Whack! I actually want to know, are guys going to have a radically different take on this film to girls?
Laura, what do you think?
Yeah, let me try and read your mind and see how you're going to
process this. Tell us what you think.
Film.
We do this all the time, telling people what they think. What do you think we think?
I think you're going to... It's definitely going to be one of the ones where you're going, okay, girlfriend, okay, wife, thanks for bringing me along to this.
Laura's correct.
Sit here awkwardly. Yes, 1 point to me. But I definitely, of course, think it is aimed at the women. But the good thing is that guys aren't excluded from the conversation because the men in the film are there, like, yes, more reactionary to what's going on in the life of their wife, their partner.
We are scenery once again, yes.
I wanted much more from those guys. They were great. Paddy Considine and Dominic Cooper as the husband and partners in this. They were fantastic. I wanted more. I want a movie about those guys.
That's the thing. Like, their perspective, their story would be great to see. There was one scene where you have a conversation with the guys. They're kind of chatting on the couch briefly, but it is this very brief sideline moment that's there for a laugh and then moved on. So this sorry, gentlemen.
But this is a massive movie about female friendship. And one of the things I did like, even though I'm a guy, was that it's a movie about friendship. Full stop. Like, you don't get too many movies about a platonic friendship between people, particularly lifelong through the ups and downs.
Did you think that reflected things well for you?
Well, I think it's rare to see female friendship represented on screen as the dominant factor because there's lots of movies about like the bro comedy kind of thing, male friendship, brotherhood, etc. That's really well thought about and people are familiar with that.
But not usually played for depth, usually played for laughs.
Yeah, I know.
Predominantly.
Let's be honest, The Hangover is not an actual replication of what people actually do.
Life is not like that for you guys.
Not normally.
But female friendship doesn't normally take center place. And I guess with female friendship, they do normally go to the deep side. So this did, I think, pick on the fact that I think for a lot of people, not just females, but a lot of people do want lifelong friendship. Someone that's going to be with them through all the ups and downs, have seen you at your best and your worst, etc. This film does give it a glossy picture because there's moments where there's tension between both Jess and Millie. And like I find they kind of acknowledge that they were annoyed by each other, but then it's all giggles, another selfie, and they move on. When in reality, I feel like that may happen to some people. That may be how they handle the difficulties in their friendship, but it's not helpful because I know, and I don't want to generalize every girl, but I know at least particularly what I find is if you don't actually address the issue, there's all the smiles and all the coffee dates, etc., but there's really, you know, issues at the core of who you are and with each other.
Yeah, I'd agree. I think one of the reasons I didn't get into the film that much, it was all right, but it felt a bit predictable. It felt like this, you just know how it's going to unfold before you go in to see this film. But we were talking about this film before, and you mentioned to me, which you're right about this, one of the more interesting things about the film, though, is the fact that it doesn't just raise sickness and people trying to deal with sickness. And Toni Collette does a pretty good job of showing someone who gets the cancer diagnosis and freaks out about it and just does all the things that you do. But it also talks about people who are impacted by that diagnosis and particularly people who feel guilty. In this case, Jess, her life's going actually quite well, even though she's trying to have a baby.
Yeah.
It actually raises the issue of people who are friends with someone going through a really hard time and how difficult that can be for the friend and the guilt that they feel.
Yeah, it was one of the things I loved most about this film was the way it covered off so many different spaces. Like maybe it raced through some of them a little bit, but here is Millie's story, but here's Jess. And she, like, it's that thing that isn't necessarily talked about. Like, what do the friends do? Because if it's like in any situation where you're witnessing a friend go through heartache or financial difficulty or whatever the case may be, and if you're going really well in something, if you've just got a promotion, how do you have the conversations and be honest about what's going on in your life with a friend who's been there through it all in the face of their personal tragedy? It's an important element, I think, to consider.
Well, that's something I really want to know about because from a Christian perspective, does it actually give us anything to work with when it comes to dealing with those really tough subjects? Do you learn anything from the film, say, hey, you know, that's actually a sensible way of helping your friends approach the crises like death or something like that?
Yeah, or death, I was going to say. Death hangs over the top of this picture. What did you think, Laura?
I think that it gives you good thoughts toward, like, what Jess is able to do is not lose the fresh, fun nature of their friendship in the face of disease, which is, I feel like, more real life because as soon as someone gets sick, obviously there's a seriousness to that. Mortality is a factor, but you're still mates and you still have personal jokes and you still have that lightheartedness. And I think one of the important things the film brings up is not to lose the essence of your friendship over the sake of a changed circumstance. Like, still identify with your friend as you always have. Be more supportive, be more sort of empathetic, I guess, to their situation. But they are your friend. They're not just suddenly rebranded as this sick person that you're now doing life with. They're your friend, so you want to keep that. But in terms of the mortality conversation...
Yeah, come on, tell us, do they actually say anything about after death or preparing for death?
It gets raised really quickly. So the care and compassion front is really quite strong throughout the film. But when it comes to what's going to happen afterwards, there's no real hope that's offered to Millie in this case. And they do have a conversation about, oh, I wonder if there's a heaven. And Jess rightfully points out that, well, that'd be pretty hypocritical of you to think about right now because you've always said that there isn't one. Mm. And then they just joke about, well, even even if there was a heaven, they're going to have to lower their standards to let you in. Like that kind of thing. So it's this one of those conversations. I'm sure plenty of people have it. You sort of want it both ways. You do want there to be a heaven. You're not really sure if it's there. You kind of want to get in. You don't know if you want to. In the end, Miss You Already just gives you a largely unanswered answer to what's on the other side.
So accurate, but just basically unhelpful.
It kind of tackles the conversation, I guess, in the way a lot of people do in this flippant, well, I sort of, depending on your background, it's sort of like, I don't really know what's going to go on here. Let's have a laugh. It's something we should acknowledge and I probably should think more deeply about and really consider, but oh, giggle, giggle, I just need to move away from it. And she does mention to her children, you know, Mum will always be with you, that very, you know, my spirit will always be here sort of a thing. Sorry.
But the daughter is fantastic in that scene and she goes, what does that mean? Yeah. And runs out of the room.
Yeah. It's like, what does that
even
mean?
That's the best line in the whole
film. I could have done that in the film.
That's death coming out there.
It points to the fact that sometimes we do say these things that really, what do they mean? Like when you say you'd love to go to heaven or you're a good person, you'll go to heaven, and we say, you know, I'll pray for you or whatever. What's the actual meaning and real spiritual position behind that? What's the consequence?
Sounds like it's a real warning, actually, to people to not offer up things which ultimately are no comfort at all.
Mm. Yeah.
Or have the answers. Like, there are answers out there. Go seek them out.
Well, Miss You Already is rated M and stars Toni Collette, Drew Barrymore and Patty Considine. Mature themes, sex scenes and coarse language all make a showing. Laura, thanks heaps for being part of the show.
No worries. Thank you.
Thank you, Laura. Now, hit us up on Facebook and tell us about romantic comedies, romantic dramas. Mark, I want to start a new word or a new phrase, rom-dram-com. Romantic drama comedy.
Dramacom.
Tell me on Facebook whether that works, but let us know your favourite romantic films of all time and why. We'd love to hear what those are, and we'll report back in a few weeks about what your favourite choices are.
And if you have a particular Burgundy or region in France that you like to refer wine from, please write that down as well.
We're available for all of that.
Mark and Ben with Big Picture, a Christian look at popular culture, which will soon go live on Hope 103.2 FM. If you're in the Sydney region, we're really looking forward to telling you that we're going on radio now from Sunday nights from November 8 at 8 p.m. till some indeterminate time afterwards. They just said keep going. I don't know what they meant. Anyway, but we'll probably finish sometime around, I don't know, 9.
We promise we'll finish. But moving on with the show today, we're up to press record for this week. Earlier in the show, we talked about The Bachelorette, the quick as a flash follow-up to this year's The Bachelor. Anne Wilson is a Sydney actress. She's worked in TV, a movie, on stage. And she had a starring role in The Bachelor. It's like, this is actually shock, a bit of a newsflash. There are actors used in reality TV. I kid you not. So for press record this week, I actually caught up with Anne to ask her.
Just defeat the whole...
I caught up with Anne this week for press record to ask her about a time on one of the year's highest rating TV shows and what she thinks is the appeal of these love contests. Anne, you're involved with The Bachelor, but you weren't one of the Bachelorettes. What exactly did you do on the show?
Well, I'm an actor and an improvisational actor.
Right.
So I was invited in to perform as a waitress.
Now, hang on a minute. This is a reality TV show we're talking about, Anne, but you're invited to improvise to act on the show?
That's right.
Right. So you're playing a waitress?
Yeah.
And so what happened in your scene?
Well, part of my brief was to not only serve food, but to flirt with the bachelor.
Right.
And perhaps be a little bit rude or cold towards the bachelorettes that were dining with him.
Did you find this difficult to character to get into, Anne?
it was a little bit fun. It was great because as it was improvised, and these are real human beings, I had no idea, the producers had no idea of the responses that we would get. And yeah, they were very human responses, and it was a really enjoyable process to be a part of.
Human responses, you mean from The Bachelor and the Bachelorettes? How many different dates were they on? So this is one of those moments in the show where it's a challenge or something, or is it? Yeah. Is that what it's called, or a challenge date? I haven't watched the show enough,
well,
obviously.
I guess it's a bit of a test. The Bachelor is trying to find the girl of his dreams, and so I was a bit of a plant to provoke the girls to some degree, to find out how they respond in certain situations.
What was it like being inside a reality TV show? I get that there must be people working on the show, and I understand it's a construction, but I think a lot of us viewers just think, oh, well, it's just happening for real in front of our eyes. What was it like being in part of the machinery of a reality TV show?
That's what struck me. It really is a machine. It's incredibly organized, well orchestrated, and it has to be, because there's so much going on and there is an unpredictable quality about reality TV that no one can necessarily know the outcome of any one scene, so to speak.
Yes.
I found it fascinating, and the element of almost feeling like you're in a documentary, you know, that this is real moments, but they've been framed within a controlled vision. Yeah, it was really fascinating to see on the inside and to be a part of that process.
And you've been involved in plays and films and other TV programs, but this sounds to me, the way you're describing it, is this right? One of the most surreal things you've done?
It was a little surreal. I do a lot of improvisational acting, and so the premise of that is you step out on stage and you don't know what you're about to say, you don't know what you're about to do. So I guess I've become comfortable with that format. But I guess having, you know, two or three cameras in your face, no rehearsal, no script, it did up the stakes of what I was doing. And the fact that there could be no second take on this, this had to be completed in the first take to get that natural response from the Bachelorettes and the Bachelor.
The Bachelor has been hugely popular on Australian TV, massive last couple of months. What do you think is at the heart of its appeal?
Every one of us, if we really admit to ourselves, we're all seeking love. I think it's that idea that someone will see us, truly see us, would get to know us and would choose us, would woo us, would see us as someone special and accept us for who we are. I think that's something very human, that we all seek that deep connection. And as an audience, it's thrilling to see that process.
That was Anne Wilson reporting back to us about what it was like, Mark, to work inside the machine, quote unquote, that is The Bachelor. Pretty extraordinary to think about.
Yeah, I'm just kind of stunned at how I shouldn't say this as a guy who produces television, but some things, reality television is supposed to be less produced.
Meant to be, apparently. But I entirely agree with what Anne said about the purpose or what the appeal is behind The Bachelor. People just want to find love. Ah, which is very fitting, given we are in our romantic comedy, romantic drama, rom-dram-com edition, Mark, of the podcast. Thank you for thank you for politely giggling at that. We're up to another now showing choice, which is Learning to Drive. It's a new film at cinemas around the place. It's starring Patricia Clarkson and Ben Kingsley. And without trying to steal your thunder, Mark, you love this movie.
I do. I love this film.
Let's play something from the clip and I'm going to ask you a few questions about it.
And joining me for today's topic, book critic Wendy Shields.
Always a pleasure. I heard about you and Ted.
Heard what exactly?
Every 7 years the itch comes over him, he gets restless, does something juvenile.
I'm not going home with you, Wendy.
Oh, instead of buying a motorcycle, Daddy decided to give adultery a spin.
Who is it?
Darwan Singh Tor, for your driving lesson, please.
What happened?
We're moving.
That's good.
It's about time you started driving.
I used to have a husband who drove.
Oh, Ted.
Look, personally, I can say that rom-coms like this one really actually are worth the price of admission. You know, now, I know
really?
This sounds funny. Listen to this storyline and be prepared to be amazed, okay? Learning to Drive stars Patricia Clarkson. She's this hapless author called Wendy, whose husband of several decades decides to leave her for a much younger, inspiring woman or whatever it is. And she's naturally devastated by the process and decides to take on driving lessons because up until then, hubby has been responsible for the car. So she does this because she wants to visit her daughter in the country. There's your setup. Her driving instructor is the seemingly bottomless well of talent, Ben Kingsley. I don't know what this guy cannot play, but now he is, in fact...
He's in The Walk as well. This is cinemas
the
around the place.
Just, pick a role. I mean, if he's not in the upcoming...
Gandhi. He should be Gandhi.
He should. If he's not in the upcoming Star Wars, I don't know what they're doing. Anyway, he's an Indian Sikh called Dhawan.
Of course.
And in Dhawan's car, Wendy learns more than just how to reverse park, but how to navigate life. And more importantly, what's worth respecting and what love really looks like.
Wow, I'm sort of yawning already though, Mark. And look, I'm a romantic comedy, romantic drama kind of guy. I like the good ones that are out there. But this, to me, just has me eye-rolling from the start.
Well,
I do not want to go see it.
No, wait, because I'm going to make you groan one step further. Okay. You see, and look, Steeler, to the end here, I'm like this film. But anyway, here's how the story goes from there. See, Darwin's a political refugee, right? And so he's from a culture that's quite used to arranged marriages. So his family arranges for a wife to come out to him, and he marries her. But of course, what's going on side by side to this is the fact that Wendy and Dhawan are taking these daily driving lessons, and there's this connection forming between them, and she's coming to love him, and he's coming to love her.
Yep. Okay, so go back to my bit about this just all sounds like predictable and yawn-worthy and eye-rolling, and you are about to tell us that it is not.
It is actually an antidote to follow love wherever it takes you. Okay, you would think at this point, the normal Hollywood take on this sort of thing is, it doesn't matter if Darwin's married, it doesn't matter if Wendy's, you know, tragic
just
life
follow your
is
heart,
behind
man.
Her.
Follow your heart.
Follow your heart. No, the film does not do this. It resists this completely.
Colour me interested.
I know, it's incredible. There are a couple of things in the film that make it much, much more responsible viewing.
Yeah, so go on and tell us, how does learning to drive pull off this quite masterful feat?
Okay, well, firstly, what it does is Wendy comes to a position where she acknowledges her own responsibility in the crash and burn of the relationship. And I think this is really, really good, okay? I'm not saying that there is no such thing as a no-fault divorce, okay, that somebody might, you know, be the main person who has caused the dilemma that crashes a marriage. But in the majority of cases, couples will look at what has happened, and if they are wise, they'll be able to see how they contributed to what went on. And Wendy will actually look at herself in this film and stop and say, you know, my husband left me, but I think I left him 2 years earlier.
In stark contrast, Miss You Already, that's also in cinemas and we've discussed in the program, the character that Toni Collette plays, Millie, does not really recognize her own responsibility in many of the situations that she is in. The most you'll get is an I'm sorry.
Yeah, and so for a rom-com, this one is set right apart.
Yeah.
Because firstly, it's not like there's this one tragic victim and they're somehow sort of delivered to the arms of love. Now, in this case, Wendy basically acknowledges that she's got some part in it. And she also learns to respect how much a relationship has to be worked at as opposed to just experienced. New territory for rom-coms again. It's not just that they're swept off their feet. It's the fact that Wendy realizes that if she wants to have a relationship that is going to have any grounds of lasting, and particularly a marriage, it is something she has to work at every day from day one till the last day. This is something she learns off Darwin. And this is just fantastic stuff. But no one in the film is a Christian, which, you know, so in a sense, you've got a couple of problems. You should probably try and work out why I'm encouraged by this.
Yeah. Well, so it's not necessarily a problem that they're not Christian in the film. You're not wanting the film to be more Christian than it is. But well, are you trying to get at the point that you're endorsing a lot of this is what I'm hearing?
I know.
You're really, really behind it.
I haven't dropped the big bomb yet.
So it's the point.
I can't wait.
It's the point you're trying to get at is as a Christian and with the Christian beliefs and teachings and understanding that you have, you are still encouraged by what Learning to Drive is putting forward. And if that's the case, why?
They come up to the cliff in the film, and I'm not going to give it
away. Like Thelma and Louise?
They come up, no, not like Thelma and Louise, though there is a car involved.
Like Cliffhanger?
They come up to the moment where in which this film can follow the well-trodden, despairing path of romantic comedy in Hollywood and go down that line of let everyone else be damned so long as we're happy.
Yes.
And they step back from it, okay? And in a most amazing way, it's really, really poignant. You come away with far more respect. From a Christian point of view, you come away with a sense of the faithfulness that is required above everything else, even when you don't feel like it. Faithfulness is far more important in the relationship because it is the faithfulness that gives value to the years and the sacrifice and the respect that is built on that. There's this wonderful moment too in the film in which Wendy actually says to Darwin, who might be tempted again to lead the direction, you know, that Hollywood wants them to go, don't, because you're the sort of man who gives me hope. And so she says that? She doesn't want to crash and burn somebody else's relationship. She wants his relationship to prosper and her to find something similar, prospering in that same sense of faithfulness. Now, look, there are things in the film that are problematic. There are sex scenes and stuff that you've got to be aware of. But look, I've got to say, it's refreshing. For a rom-com, it's refreshing. It is not throw everything out the window and embrace love only. It is not that selfish. It's actually a film that talks about faithfulness and respect in a way that I can get behind.
That's a pretty powerful endorsement. So Learning to Drive is at cinemas all around the place, somewhere near you, starring Patricia Clarkson and Ben Kingsley. And it's rated? I presume it's rated?
It's rated M. Like I said, there's some sex, nudity, mature themes you've got to get across, some coarse language. It is a New York film. But that said, you know, these things are contextual and not really a big issue.
Okay, that's now showing this week, Learning to Drive. Still to come on the program, Mark, we're going to hear about the greatest romantic comedy ever. And I'm also going to list off the top five screen couples. Stick around.
You're staring at The Big Picture with Ben and Mark, and we've chosen our rom-com week to introduce a new segment to our lineup. Welcome to The Vault.
Welcome.
Echo, 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 echo.
Echo.
Adrian Drayton, longtime Australian reviewer and editor of Insights Magazine, has been collecting movie discs for quite a while. Truth be known, each week Australian distributors back a dump truck up to his lawn and pour out a trailer load of new release titles that basically make a real mess of his Penistum Clandestinum, which is Kikuyu grass for you and me. But that's the detail to which Adrian goes to understand what grows in the fetid shrubberies of Hollywood backlots. And so we send Ben off to ask him to dig through his amazing collection and tell us his favourite romantic comedy.
Adrian, this is our first Vault segment on The Big Picture. We sent you off into the massive movie archive. You went deep down subterranean. You've emerged all dusty back into the sunlight. We gave you the task of finding a great, 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 great romantic comedy. What did you come up with?
When I was looking through romantic comedies, the 90s had Notting Hill, My Best Friend's Wedding, You've Got Mail and Sleepless in Seattle. But I think the winner, and one probably that has influenced a lot of those films, is the classic When Harry Met Sally, which came out in 1989.
Oh, mate, that's a fantastic place for The Vault to start off with.
It's kind of the benchmark against which I reckon a lot of romantic comedies have actually been judged.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the film was written by Nora Ephron, who went to write some of the other films that I've mentioned.
Yes.
This is definitely Meg Ryan and Billy Crystal's film, and they star as Harry and Sally, or Sally and Harry, as the case may be. The film begins in 1977 with a road trip to New York and continues through a decade-long friendship as they navigate the various ups and downs of their lives. The film, I guess, is essentially one long conversation about relationships and marriage. The dialogue is peppered with the now well-known observations about men and women, which have really kind of become cultural touchstones to some degree.
Is this part of the reason of why you think When Harry Met Sally is such a great example of romantic comedies and why you would recommend people watch it now?
Absolutely. It hasn't really dated. Unlike today's romantic comedies, which rely on pratfalls and various things to get the couples together, the chemistry between Ryan and Crystal just works.
Yeah.
And they both became regulars in similar films throughout the 80s, 90s and early 2000s. Meg Ryan's pedantic cappuccino with the froth on the side characteristics and Billy Crystal's sloppy live-in-the-moment ways have kind of endured and have informed a lot of romantic comedies since, with the kind of mismatched values of the couple. But I think the beauty for me of the film is that it's observational. Even though it's almost like one long conversation, it's very observational about what it says about relationship. For me, the whole film is sort of a long dissertation, that's a bit of a big word to use, on the differences between men and women.
So out of all of those things that you've just mentioned there, and we keep going back to When Harry Met Sally is an incredible observation of men and women relating to each other. In real life, what can we take away from When Harry Met Sally?
I think in real life, it has value because of what they talk about, the differences between men and women. It talks a lot about partnership and friendship in marriage. And although Billy Crystal's Harry says that men and women can't be friends, they have to be romantically linked. I think that's actually, the film bears out the fact that they can be friends and that a relationship can grow, and that the point of mutual friendship, their mutual friendship after their respective breakups of relationships is really, really quite poignant. It's interesting to observe the relationship dynamics And I guess you kind of can overlay your own relationship on what they're talking about. It's a really great film that really does stand the test of time and really is a real classic. And I think the best quote for me in the film, which really stands out, and it's towards the end, I guess that's a bit spoilery. Billy Crystal's Harry says to Sally, "When you realise you want to spend the rest of your life with somebody, you want the rest of your life to start as soon as possible."
My wife and I actually, our bridal waltz it had to be you. We're just so in love with this film. Good on you, Adrian. I love this man.
I
really do.
I just think it's great when we start out a new segment on the show and ask someone to do it and they do what we want, which is pick a really good movie, man. Don't embarrass us.
Yeah. Not like our resident American. Hey, Russ.
Oh, come on.
We'll get back.
If you want to check out more of Adrian's reviews and the rest of the Insights team, head across to insights.uca.org.au. That website again, insights.uca.org.au. Check out their reviews weekly updated, including our favourite American, Russ Matthews, yes, who reviews regularly for Insights and does a really good job.
And he is very good.
Top five time, Mark. It's the end of the show. And
this is our rom-com week. I don't want to think of it so much as the end as the climax. The point at which we get to hear your top five list of
Screen couples.
Oh, look, I'm just going to relax in my comfy chair. We've moved a Jason recliner into the studio. So
we should have sat more
back
side by side in we the studio for this. Hugged as I hit the button on
five.
1997's Titanic, Jack and Rose.
Yes.
There you go.
That is a respectable place to begin.
Yeah, look, as much as I'm not a huge fan of the movie, it turns out majority of the world is, because that movie still is ranked number 2 highest grossing film of all time, which is really the main reason I picked this on this list, is because there's no, apart from Avatar, which is at the top of the list.
Another great couple film.
But that couple, maybe not so memorable. Given
they were blue.
They were blue and they had giant ponytails. That's all people remember. But instead, Titanic, as much as that was about the destruction of that boat and it sinking into the ocean, what really seemed to draw people back into cinemas was Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet as Jack and Rose, these lovers who are from different sections of the boat, one from the bottom, one from the top.
Different areas in society.
But true love, and even the boat going down, can't stop them from being so lovey-dovey that people want to spend so much money at the box office that it's the second highest grossing film ever.
Do you want to hear something really sappy about this film?
I would, yes.
I actually, while I was dating my wife, this film came out, and I actually sent her a bouquet of flowers with the soundtrack of Titanic embedded in the flowers. I know. And
she married you. So it worked out.
I know. This is what you're saying. Like, this is the sort of crazy stuff people will do when they're in love. However, recently my wife pulled the CD off the shelf and went, "Who bought this?"
To which you answered, "King of the World.
I love you too."
Four.
From 1997, that was Titanic. 1977, Annie Hall, Diane Keaton and Woody Allen together in that film. I picked it at number four on this list because they, I think, define the best of oddball couples in cinema. The quirky, cool people, the people that know way too much, they're a little bit awkward, talk way, way too much about themselves, about all kinds of things, but still there's something so amazingly appealing about them that you do want them to stick together, even though as Annie Hall goes along, you pretty much are hoping that they don't. At the same time.
Yeah.
So Woody Allen was playing Alvy Singer, Diane Keaton was playing Annie Hall. And for, I think it's alongside When Harry Met Sally, as great as a choice that was with Adrian Drayton to pick in the vault, Annie Hall is up there as greatest romantic comedy of all time.
Do you want to hear a really sappy story about this one?
And for everybody listening out there, we didn't set this up. And I too am surprised that every time I say something now, Mark's going to say,
"When my wife and I were dating, seriously." We watched this film. She actually chose this film. And she said, "I want to show you a film. This is a fantastic film." So it was this huge event. We actually sort of like projected it on a wall at the place I was staying at. We put a carpet, a mat down. We had a picnic inside, all sorts of stuff. I slept through it. But we still got married.
What?
I know. It's a good film. I don't know what happened. Far too much Camembert.
Wow. Despite Mark's going to sleep during that film, they still
it
rank
was a good film.
Alvy Singer and Annie Hall, number 4.
We got married.
I'm really interested in knowing how you're going to get a story about your dating relationship with your now wife into the number 3 choice, which is Luke Skywalker and Darth Vader.
No,
go ahead.
I'm drawing.
Funny guy.
I'm drawing a blank.
Go ahead, Mr. Memories, Mr. Nostalgia, Mr. Dating, to the tune of Luke and Darth. So we didn't say at the start of this list, even though we are at a romantic comedy, romantic drama edition, we didn't narrow it down so much that it had to be a romance. Instead, I just went for what's a really memorable screen couple. And I think when it comes to the kind of polar opposites, when we're talking in this case, particularly on a universal scale, who represents good and evil the best on screen? I think in a close-knit relationship that you really kind of can't pull them apart, Luke Skywalker and Darth Vader.
Yeah, and actually, interestingly, it's true. This is true. While we were dating, my wife actually used to refer to me as Evil Mark.
Darth Vader, I'm confused now.
Yeah, well, you know, best to go on to number two.
Thank you. Thank you for that addition. So at number three, Luke Skywalker and Darth Vader, across the entirety of the Star Wars franchise, they are an amazingly memorable couple.
It was a pet name.
Possibly not as memorable as...
Two.
Okay, Mark, like think back through your dating history about 1942's Casablanca.
No. Oh. No. We did not at any stage watch Casablanca while we were dating.
Oh, thanks for ruining the tension.
It was the first year of our marriage when we were settling into our new home together. That's when you watch Casablanca.
Yeah, and pretty much every year after that, such an amazing romantic drama from cinema history. It stars Humphrey Bogart and Ingrid Bergman, and they're playing Rick and Ilsa. I could have picked any of the other movies that Humphrey Bogart and Katharine Hepburn were in particularly. I think they really demonstrate the golden era of Hollywood cinema and how you had actors who had amazing chemistry and gravity and could always pour themselves into these characters and make you believe that they were someone different, even though they're exactly the same screen pairing all the time. But I think Casablanca really stands out, and particularly for, and we've spoken about it on this program at different times, the ending of Casablanca. And I'm sure most people know it, even if they haven't seen the movie, but the way that you are led throughout the entire film, in a similar way to Learning to Drive, where you think that this couple at the center of it, despite the fact that she's married and Rick has been bitter for years about the fact that Ilsa is his lost love, she returns, she's married, you keep thinking they're going to get together throughout the film. It really looks like you really kind of want that to happen, but the ending turns it on its head and becomes this amazing self-sacrificial portrait of a screen couple and how people who are really intimately acquainted, one can still do the right thing and do what's better for the other person, which actually may be not staying together.
It's brilliant for that conclusion.
One.
I'm ready.
You are?
Yeah, please help me out. What is your top
couple film?
Go
back to the bit where I said that this may not necessarily be a list of best screen romantic couples. Keep that in mind, because at number one is The Shawshank Redemption.
As your couple film.
As my couple
film. As your great couples.
As a great screen couple. Andy and Red, as played by Tim Robbins and Morgan Freeman. I repeat, there's no romantic involvement here in this film. But if you go to...
No, for two guys in prison. I'm glad.
If, as you're listening, you call up on the interwebs, the IMDb, Internet Movie Database, you go to, in their menu, the top 250 movies of all time, and the highest ranked film on that list, and it has been for years and years and years, is The Shawshank Redemption. So... In similar to picking Titanic at number five, which loads of people went to see, as turns out by the box office results, people love Shawshank Redemption. And I think it's got a lot to do with the coupling at the center of this film between Andy Dufresne, a guy who gets put in jail, claims he's innocent, wants to bust out, and Red, who's this long-timer, this guy's been in prison forever, doesn't know how he'll survive on the outside. And there's something about the respect, the camaraderie, the closeness these men generate without... going overboard either. They say a lot, they say a little, all those kind of things. Heartwarming, Mark.
Do you want to hear a sappy story?
I'd love to.
Seriously. When we were dating, okay, look, I'll just take you into the plot for a second. You know that Andy and Morgan Freeman's character
Red.
Is Red, yep. They get to the end of the film and after all the trials and tribulations they've been on and they get to the beach and there's Andy waiting for him and he's standing there and the whole life is about to begin. The shirt that Andy's wearing, Maya bought that for me.
What? That's an awesome story.
There you go.
But not nearly as awesome as playing a clip from The Shawshank Redemption, which does hit number one on my top five screen couples list of all time.
I don't think I could make it on the outside, Andy. I've been in here most of my life. I'm an institutional man now. It's like Brooks was.
Well, you underestimate yourself.
I don't think so.
In here, I'm the guy who can get things for you, sure, but outside, all you need is the yellow pages. Hell, I wouldn't even know where to begin. Pacific Ocean? Shit. About to scare me to death, something that big.
Not me. I didn't shoot my wife, and I didn't shoot her lover. Whatever mistakes I made, I paid for them, and then some. That hotel, that boat, I don't think that's too much to ask.
Ah, great point to end the show on, Mark.
And the shirt he's wearing.
And the shirt he's wearing. That was the show for this week.
And coming up next week, it's a killer show. Actually, literally, it's a killer show. I take a look at the return of the hit television series Fargo.
And I'm going to get all gangster with Johnny Depp in Black Mass.
And we take a death-defying trip with Joseph Gordon-Levitt on a high wire over arguably the world's most infamous crime scene.
That is all happening next week. And this week, I do declare I have been Ben McKechnie.
And I remain Mark Hadley. See you next week.